Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. The Oso Area mudslide in Washington will likely go down as one of the most deadly natural disasters in Northwest history. As searches turn from rescue to recovery, some are asking if the severity of this slide could have been predicted. And we'll hear from Scott Burns, a geologist at Portland State University. He says a comprehensive system of insurance like the one in New Zealand would lessen the costs of recovery.
Every house in the country has all-hazard insurance, which covers earthquakes, floods, volcanic eruptions, tsunamis, and landslides.
We'll hear more about the slide in Washington, take a look back at two tsunamis that took place in our area in the 1960s, and hear about citizen disaster training coming soon to Nehalem. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Saturday's deadly slide was just the latest in a long string of landslides to hit the area known as the Hazel Slide along the North Fork Stillaguamish River, 60 miles northeast of Seattle, Washington. State and tribal officials have been trying to fend off slides at that spot for half a century, John Ryan reports.
The Tulalip tribes were so concerned with landslides hitting the river and its prime salmon habitat that they blocked a proposed timber sale above the Hazel Slide.
This had been known at least since the 50s as one of the more problematic areas on the Stillaguamish River for perennial landsliding.
Geologist Paul Kennard worked for the Tulalip tribes in the late 80s. A timber company had clear-cut part of the slope above the landslide zone. The tribes reached a settlement, stopping an expansion of that timber sale.
Well, it was our contention that harvest...
That's land manager speak for logging.
Harvest in the area just above the slide would increase the amount of groundwater. And essentially, the largest factor in causing the slide was an increase in groundwater.
Geologists say without big trees to suck up rainwater, more water runs underground, where it can lubricate the already unstable soil in landslide zones. That's why the state has restricted logging above landslide-prone slopes like Hazel for the past 14 years.
On the Hazel landslide, the one we're talking about, it's happened four times. There was cutting in the 1940s, it failed in the 50s. There was cutting in 1960. And then it failed in the mid-60s. There was cutting in 88, it failed in 91. There was cutting in 2005, and it failed in 2006, and in 2014.
That latest clear cut in 2005 was much smaller than earlier cuts. Kennard says it would take a geotechnical study to know whether the recent logging affected Saturday's slide. I'm John Ryan in Seattle.
In Oregon, geologic hazards can easily be accessed online. The Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, or DGAMI, has developed a series of interactive maps depicting hazards including 100-year flooding, Cascadia subduction zone earthquake shaking and tsunami, coastal erosion and landslides, with links to seismic assessment reports. Oregon residents can input their home address for quick identification of hazards affecting their property. For Washington residents, options are more scattered and more difficult to find. Public Radio KUOW's Marcy Silman spoke with slide expert and geologist Scott Burns about geologic mapping of hazards in Washington.
Scott Burns is on the faculty at Portland State University. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you this morning.
Counties can make good landslide hazard maps. Most don't do it. Where in Washington State do we have good landslide hazard maps?
One of the best ones is down in Cowlitz County. They had the 1998 landslide, the Kelso landslide, which was an incredible landslide that destroyed 60 houses. DNR in Washington responded and put out what I think is an excellent example of landslide susceptibility or hazard mapping for that county. Where are the potential hazards and where they aren't?
Why don't more cities or counties act proactively and get good landslide hazard mapping?
And I wish they would, but every county budget or city budget is stressed. They just don't have enough money. And unless they are pushed to the point of being asked to do that, they won't spend that money for that. We do have nationally all of our flood hazard maps. And so you can find out if you're in a floodplain or not and if you need to have flood hazard insurance And same thing with earthquakes. But with landslides, that's the third geological hazard that we have here in the Pacific Northwest that we need to be paying attention to, but we haven't produced enough of those maps in the past. We have the ability to make really, really good maps because we have LIDAR, which is this laser imaging system where we can see right through the trees, see the ground, and see where past landslides have occurred in the past. That's the first step in making a really good quality map.
You mentioned that Cowlitz County responded after a landslide. In the case of Oso, it sounds like new construction was permitted after a landslide hit the very same hillside just not very long ago, 2006. The Army Corps of Engineers did have a report on the risk of a catastrophic slide that dated back to 1999. Would better information or better mapping would necessarily have made people safer?
It's all a communication thing. The county had the information. The problem is it did not get communicated to the commissioners and the county or the land use planners. And they should have not allowed those permits to have been given.
Why do you think that landslide insurance is a key to make people safer?
Well, this is the last of the major geological hazards that that normal homeowners insurance does not cover, and it is rare that people will get landslide insurance. You can buy it through Lloyd's of London. They're the ultimate insurers, but it's so expensive, a minimum of $1,000 a year, and it goes up from there. 50, 60 years ago, we couldn't get earthquake insurance or flood hazard insurance. Eventually, the insurance companies got enough information on those particular hazards, and now you, as a homeowner, can buy additional insurance for those two other major hazards. Landslides aren't in that particular case yet, even though they're devastating. All those people who lost their houses there in the Oso landslide have lost everything, and there's no insurance covering them. And we lost lives, that is the worst thing, but then also property is the second thing. And so what we need to do is go to the next level. Hopefully, this will be enough of an impetus to take us to the next level and put more pressure on insurance companies to possibly come forward with landslide insurance. If not, a great example is New Zealand, where I used to live. I was down in the country when they had the big earthquake a couple of years ago. And they have all-hazard insurance. Every house in the country has all-hazard insurance, which covers earthquakes, floods, volcanic eruptions, tsunamis, and landslides. And so everybody pays into this. And so if you have an event, you're covered. And I'm hoping that someday we get to that level here in the United States. And it's going to take time.
Scott Burns is a landslide expert and geologist at Portland State University. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, too.
Forty-nine years ago, at 1:20 a.m., January 30th, 1965, a landslide-triggered tsunami overran Puget Island in the Columbia River near Cathlamet, Washington. The landslide originated from Bradwood Point on the Oregon side of the river. At that hour, island residents were sleeping in their homes and had little warning of the impending tsunami. Kay Chamberlain, then Peterson, was then a young girl whose family lived along North Welcome Slough on Puget Island. She recalled the events of that morning.
I was up in my bedroom. And I felt this rumbling. We thought it was an earthquake. And there was a lot of noise. And I went to my window and I pulled it down. And I could just hear noise. Just this loud noise and then crashing. You could hear the boats and the boathouses by us crashing. Just the noise was just crashing. And then that's when the wave came up the slough, and then it's a dead end slough, so then it went back out. And what didn't sink as it came in and flooded things pretty much took care of things when it went out. Our boathouse was just mangled in pieces. Not until morning's light did we get to see the destruction of, at that time, lots of boats and lots of boathouses on Welcome Slough. And they were just in different states of destroyed. And the roads were just, they're blocked with debris, water over on the inside of the dike. And that's when we learned that one man had died. Their house had sat on the outside of the dike, right across from where the bluff fell off.
The wave killed one person, Håkon Gabrielsen, age 59. The Wakayakum Eagle newspaper published a photo of the ground where his house had stood before the tsunami. The only recognizable part of the house was the exposed remains of the water supply pipe. Gabrielsen's body was recovered from a nearby field. The newspaper reported another woman escaped with her life. Anita Olsen was sleeping in her home when the wave carried across a dike. Although the home was destroyed, she escaped without serious injury. Fifty years ago today, a lethal tsunami hit the northwest coast just hours after a major earthquake in Alaska on March 27, 1964. The lessons learned from that event and others since then have spurred citizen interest and participation in emergency planning and preparedness. Jacob Lewin reports from Newport on the Oregon coast.
50 years ago, here at Beverly Beach on a starlit night, the McKenzie family from Tacoma was camping in a lean-to. A tsunami took away their children. A magnitude 9 quake off Alaska in 1964 generated a series of waves that grew dramatically higher as they reached the coast 4 hours later. In Cannon Beach, the downtown was flooded and houses floated away. Peter Lindsay watched from high ground.
There was suddenly this sort of hissing and quiet drawback of the water receding toward the ocean. And then it began approaching the shoreline again, and it was like 100 freight trains. You could hear logs crashing and gnashing up against one another, and they rumbled around at the foot of the point and shook the earth.
Lincoln County Commissioner Terry Thompson, a fisherman, had been out to sea after the tsunami. He docked in Crescent City, California, and had a look around.
It was like the bomb went off in Crescent City. There was only one cement building left standing, and the rest of it was just flattened.
There were 5 deaths in Oregon, the 4 kids at Beverly Beach, and a woman who died of a heart attack in Seaside, and 10 in Crescent City. It had an impact on Sue Graves' family in Depot Bay.
I remember as a child, my family, we had a tsunami plan. If we feel an earthquake, we're going to jump into the station wagon and hightail it up to the top of Cullen Street, which was the highest point in Depot Bay. And if we're not near the car, we're all going to run up there and meet there.
The state has now mapped the entire coast, outlining tsunami inundation zones, some for a distantly triggered tsunami, like the one in 1964, the rest stretching further inland in case of a near offshore quake. Ian Maiden, chief scientist for the Oregon Department of Geology, says there have also been geological changes.
During that intervening 50 years, the coast has moved about 6 feet to the northeast. The Oregon coast is actually stuck to the ocean floor, and the whole thing is moving to the northeast at a couple inches per year. And that fact that it's moving is what is going to cause an earthquake in the future.
Research from Oregon State University, based on evidence of quakes here over thousands of years, says there's a 37% chance of a major earthquake from Newport south to Eureka, California, and up to a 20% chance north to Astoria in the next 50 years. Oregon's official state resilience plan says a magnitude 9 quake could result in up to 10,000 deaths. Still, we're far better prepared for that quake and resulting tsunami now than 50 years ago. I jumped into Terry Thompson's pickup, and we drove near Newport's oceanfront, where poles are marked with blue and red tape.
Here's a red one, so that's in the zone, see? So you just know if you're in a red zone, you need to get to a blue zone. Fairly simple. In the case of a nearshore earthquake that creates a tsunami, the shaking of the ground is going to tell you it's time. The second you feel the shaking, you got 14, 15, 18 minutes to get to high ground, so you better start walking.
County emergency management systems have created reverse 911 systems to call residents and door-to-door notification. Many communities have tsunami escape routes with signs and assembly areas. Lincoln City and Depot Bay have sirens. Cannon Beach has loudspeakers comprising the Coastal Warning System, or COWS.
This is a test.
Efforts have been made to move schools out of inundation zones, a bond issue to move three Seaside School District schools out of tsunami danger zones failed, one to do the same in Lincoln County passed, and safety coordinator Sue Graves says that means all of the Lincoln County schools are out of the danger zone.
We all sleep a lot better at night.
Communities and school districts have also established caches of goods, including tents, blankets, food, and medical supplies.
Here are the two containers we have for our Newport schools. And they are 20x8 steel shipping containers. And let's open them up and check them out. In this one, we have our 55-gallon barrels full of water.
Speaking of water, 50 years ago in Cannon Beach, there was no fresh water to be found. But Peter Lindsay says you could get a cup of coffee at June Sweeney's Cafe.
A child had been preparing for a bath, and she'd drawn the bath water for her son, Hotsey. And at the time of the tidal wave, they left the home. When they got back, the water was still in the bathtub. So for the next 3 or 4 days, she used that bath water for the coffee that she served.
We may need that kind of innovation. A state report says in the event of a magnitude 9 quake and tsunami, water and electric service to some parts of the coast may be cut off for a year or more. In Newport, I'm Jacob Lewin.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Still ahead, natural disasters can strike with little or no warning, but the odds for survival increase with advanced planning and preparation. The Nehalem Bay Community Emergency Response Team will conduct training sessions over 4 days, the evening of Friday, April 25th, then all day Saturday and Sunday, the 26th and 27th, plus a final exercise and disaster simulation on the afternoon of Sunday, May 4th. We'll hear details about the training coming up just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Widespread showers this morning, then numerous showers this afternoon. Southwest winds 5 to 15 miles per hour, gusting to 30 miles per hour. The chance of precipitation near 100% with rainfall amounts a tenth to a quarter of an inch. High temperatures today around 50 degrees. Then tonight, more rain with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour, shifting to the south 5 to 15 miles per hour after midnight. Overnight lows tonight in the mid-40s. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says next in line is another moist system that will push in moderate, occasional heavy rain with a warm front, then a cold front tonight into tomorrow. For the weekend, look for post-frontal showers Saturday, then increasing showers with a disturbance Sunday, a rainy Monday, then back to showers on Tuesday. A lot has changed over the years in the way individuals and communities respond to a disaster. After the Great Coastal Gale of 2007, coastal communities were cut off from the outside world for several days. Self-reliance is the new watchword for emergency planners, and more residents than ever before are seeking training in one or more aspects of community response. Well, coming up at the end of April is a training for CERT, or Community Emergency Response Teams. And the specific training is happening for people in Nehalem, Manzanita, and Wheeler. This morning in the studio, we have Bill Harshberger, a supervisor for CERT, and Paula Peek, who also takes care of CERT duties as well as planning and map your neighborhood. Good morning, Bill and Paula.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First, can you tell us what CERT is?
CERT is a volunteer corps, so that people are trained to respond to particular natural disasters or respond to, for the community. Certain members are trained in disaster preparedness, first aid, fire safety, light search and rescue, the incident command system, disaster psychology, terrorism, and then after the end of the training program, we conduct a final exercise in which we have a simulated disaster, and people get a chance to use the skills that they've learned in the training class.
Earlier we were talking about CERT as being part of the volunteer corps, emergency volunteer corps, and could you explain what that is and how what the part that CERT takes place in it?
I'll let Paul explain what that is.
Okay. Well, after the storm in 2007 that a lot of people remember, we realized as a community or communities how vulnerable and how unprepared we were for natural disasters or otherwise. And so we brought a model from the state of Washington called Map Your Neighborhood into the community, and we trained volunteer neighborhood captains with using that model and they taking it to their neighbors. And from that, we found out that people wanted more training, and so we began the CERT program about that time, and we had 7 people to start with, and now we have over 70 people.
Yeah, we've trained over 70, including people from outside our area. We trained people from Clatsop County, people from Tillamook, people from south end of Tillamook County. Also, some people from Portland came out for training.
And then after the CERT program, we also started a ham radio club called the Hamsters. And many of us are cross-trained in all of these disciplines. We also have now a new Medical Reserve Corps. The Red Cross is a good partner of ours. We have a food committee that's thinking of long-term food issues, and we have a WASH, which is...
Water, sanitation, and hygiene.
Thank you. So all of this fits under one volunteer organization called Emergency Volunteer Corps of Nehalem Bay.
Coordination of the various volunteers and agencies has to be handled during an emergency. That sounds like something that relates to the incident command system.
Yes.
And that's something that people will be learning about during this upcoming CERT training. Could you explain exactly what that is and why it works?
Well, one issue is CERT does not self-activate. So if there's a situation, a disaster or an emergency, we are activated by the incident commander, in which case it may be the mayor of one of the towns, Manzanita, Nehalem, or Wheeler, or it may be the fire chief, or it could be the police chief. And so they activate CERT, and then we respond going to shelters or going to an assigned place for assembly, and then following the directions that they give us. Recently, a month ago, it happened when we had the big snowstorm that CERT was called out, and Paula was directing traffic. And
in the snow, in the dark.
Yeah.
Learned a lot.
With your ham radio.
Well, not with my ham radio, with somebody else's ham radio.
Okay.
And this was the recent snowstorm where a lot of travelers through our area got stuck just because they couldn't get through in their vehicles.
Right. They couldn't get across the Neoconee Mountain. So it was closed both on the north side and the south side.
Bill had to walk about, what, a mile and
about
a half
three
in the
miles,
snow, 3 miles in the snow at night to get from his vehicle. But that was another case where, you know, we had some training. I didn't feel like I had enough training. That's something we're going to have to do more of. But having the ham radio component and some traffic control from our training through our fire department, that was all useful.
So in each of these situations, CERT was up front, CERT was there with volunteers to help in this variety of circumstances, tsunami, snowstorm, and then, Bill, you were talking earlier about lost children on the beach.
Oh, yeah, we have a cooperative program with the local police chief that two or three times in the summer that there may be a child lost on the beach. And so we are going through training exercises to be responding to the local policemen to help them search for the lost child on the beach. We had a drill about a week and a half ago where we were called out by the police chief, and we were able to find the child in about half an hour.
20 minutes.
Yeah. But one of the reasons, they also call out the Tillamook County search and rescue. They call out the fire department and so forth. But because CERT is dispersed throughout the community, we're closest to the beach. I mean, Paula lives across the street from the beach. But we're closest to the beach, and we can assemble faster and respond faster. And so we're still working to improve our efficiency, but it worked quite well in the drill a couple weeks ago.
Each part of the volunteer corps, of course, relies on volunteers. If people want to get involved and learn more so they can become trained for various emergency situations, tell about the CERT training coming up at the end of April.
Okay. Again, it will be the last weekend in April and the first Sunday in May. It's Friday night, Saturday all day, and Sunday all day, and then the following Sunday for about 3 hours for the trainees. And we welcome people from out of the community. If you don't have a CERT training going on near you and you want to come, we'd love to have you. We have, as Bill said, we've trained people from other communities in Tillamook and Clatsop County. And we're always happy to cross-train with people because during disasters we may be working together. So it's always great to know each other, know our skills and our resources and that sort of thing.
For this upcoming training on the Friday night, it's an evening class. What kind of hours?
It'll start at about 6:30 and go till 9 or 9:30, depending on how long people talk and what we're covering that evening. Then we start on 8:30 the next day and go till 5 o'clock, and the same thing on Sunday, 8:30 to 5.
And then the following, the final on May 4th?
That's
correct.
Right.
That'll be about 2 to 3 hours. The other thing we should mention is Paula has started a teen CERT program at Neoconee High School, and she should talk about that. That's been an excellent program for the last 3 or 4 years.
We just finished our fourth year with the school, and it's a very cool program because it really offers the kids an alternative for what they're going to do with their lives. We have had several students who have made choices to become paramedics or firefighters, some interested in being police, that sort of thing, because of the people, all of the experts in the area that we have come in and train these students and talk about their life experiences and how they got into that line of work. But they also learn life skills that they can use their whole life long, first aid, CPR, how to use an AED, how to take charge of an incident if they're the first ones there, and how to what to do first and what to do next and how to get help and that sort of thing.
We also hope that they will train their parents and get them involved in the volunteer program.
Well, thank you, Paula Peek and Bill Harshberger, for coming in and talking to us today.
You're welcome.
You're
it's
welcome.
Our pleasure.
That is all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's N-E-W-S, then the numeral 1, at kmun.org. I'm Kathleen Morgain saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.